Before I get started, I wanted to make sure I give a big shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a stress and mind body coach based out of Los Angeles. You might remember that she guest hosted the podcast back in January, and in two consecutive Augusts, August 2021 and August 2022, she came on live with me, came to the garage, came to the office, came to the studio, whatever we want to call it, and we talked about a variety of things. The most recent one, episode 238, was all about stress. Jeannie spent 16 years battling fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and a myriad of other chronic symptoms that left her physically and mentally exhausted. She healed herself completely, and now she's obsessed with getting her clients fast results through her one-on-one coaching program. In her program, clients learn how to decrease stress, release their stuck negative emotions, and finally heal that chronic pain. Are you feeling stuck in your journey? Are you frustrated because you're familiar with TMS concepts but haven't seen much improvement? Are you sick of everyone talking about feeling their emotions because you just don't know how to do it? Perhaps you're now realizing that you can't keep doing this on your own. Jeannie offers a free 30-minute consult where she'll identify what's holding you back so that you can take the next steps in your healing. Check out her website. Go to jeanniecolwin.com. That's JeannieColwin.com and book your free call to see if it's a good fit. Welcome back to the podcast. It is September the 28th, and before I get rolling with today, we've got a new patron of the podcast since the last time I recorded one. Daniel, let me give a big shout out to Daniel. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, helping continue the steamroll of this labor of love, and throw a few dollars in the tip jar, go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. To learn more. So Daniel, thank you for coming on board. I'll also give a shout out to Kirk and Emily, Brent, Paul, Amanda, Elise, Enda, Dominic, Sasha, Sylvie, James, John, Jason, Mindy, Irina, Kelly, Tony, Michael, Mike, Christina, Ross, Julie, Brian, Arnie, and Barb. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the podcast. Again, patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. Well, listeners, the COVID finally got me. Gosh, after 2 years and 2.5 years of successfully averting it, it finally got me. My best, let me look at a calendar. My best guess is that I caught it on Saturday, September 17th at the University of Washington and Michigan State Spartans football game. And last week really kicked my ass. So, it's a bummer because on the 16th, I've done a lot of really good interviews. I've interviewed a lot of really interesting people, and there's been a lot of really good conversations. The one that I'm airing today with Julie Markowitz, who's on for the upteenth time. No, I'm just kidding. It's not quite that many. Fourth time, fifth time, something like that. We talk about it. Was one of the best ones I think that I've done. She just completed some of her training around somatic experiencing, and that's what today is all about. So, without further ado, I'll come in a future episode, maybe next week, and talk a little bit more about my COVID experience, because it was a doozy. And yeah, it was a doozy. We'll leave it at that. Julie Markowitz is back. If you want to learn more about her after this interview, her information is in the show notes. And so I encourage you to go check it out. But without further ado, here is Julie and I. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. And I think this person is on for a record fifth time. I've had a lot of people that have come on a couple of times, but Julie Markowitz from San Diego is here for her fifth appearance. Julie, can you hear me?
I can.
Congratulations. The trophy is in the mail. I appreciate you coming on again. If you haven't heard any of the previous episodes that Julie's been on, it's episode 92, 105, 120, and then most recently it was 153, which seems like it should have been recent, but I was just looking and it was actually December of 2020, so it's been quite some time. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I sent you a message on Instagram maybe a month ago, just kind of see how things were going. And you said that I had just been thinking about you because it had been a long time since I had talked to you. And you told me that you finished your somatic experiencing training. So I want to dive into that first. I've talked about somatic tracking on the podcast before. But I would love to hear from like a therapist perspective, especially somebody that's trained in this now. What is the difference, if there is one, between like a somatic tracking and somatic experiencing? Or is there a difference?
There is definitely a difference. So the way I understand somatic tracking, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that it's really just following what's going on in the body and noticing it. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. I call it the watcher, but you're just paying attention to it with no judgment.
So somatic experiencing is actually very different. Somatic experiencing is all about healing the nervous system and pendulation, which means that we go into some of these uncomfortable sensations or images or whatever's coming up, and then we come out of them into a positive experience and vacillate between the two in the person's capacity to be able to do that. And so that retrains the nervous system to not only go into trauma, but be able to come out of trauma and experience the world as safer. So you're not always in fight or flight or freeze, that you have more flexibility to move between the two of them, if that makes sense.
Give me an example, because I'm taking some notes here. Give me an example of like the, and maybe this isn't the word that you use, but like the reassociate to a positive experience. Give me an example.
Sure. So I'll give an example from my own life. I used to feel really unsafe in my bedroom. Everything I looked at brought up a pathway of trauma for me. So I might look at a painting and be like, I got this painting when this bad thing happened to me.
Oh, yeah.
And so the way my practitioners worked with me was by noticing something that was neutral or positive in my environment and not seeing it as dangerous. So it might be like, oh, I really like the colors of that painting. The blue is so calming to me. How do I notice that inside? And that might not be a bodily sensation. That might just be like, huh, I noticed that my thought patterns changed to not thinking that it feels like terrible to me. It's like, oh, this might be a positive association with the ocean. And then I see the ocean. And that reprograms the nervous system to not experience something that felt dangerous as dangerous, if that makes sense.
Is there like a necessity for repetition? And that, like, let's continue with the painting example, because I think that's an easy one for most people to visualize. Is there a necessity for repetition on that? So I look at this painting and reframe the first time or initially, and then is the idea that I'm doing it again and again to try and almost like build a different pattern, or is it not necessarily that?
Absolutely. So it's going to take a while to see whatever felt is traumatic as not traumatic, like positive or neutral. And what happens is the person really has to practice not going into that neural pathway of trauma and building a new neural pathway of like, oh, there's something not terrible about this. And it might actually be, at first it's like, oh, it's not terrible. Like, let's sit with the fact that it's not terrible. Then a couple months later, it might be, oh, it's neutral. Let's sit with it being neutral. How do you notice that in your experience? And I want to reiterate again that it's not necessarily a bodily experience. It could be whatever it feels inside to you. And for inside, that might be very different from person to person. And then it might be later, you're like, oh, I actually really like this painting, huh? And then it might be associated with a really nice experience. And then that becomes what we refer to as a resource. So it's like, oh, when something bad comes up for me, I'm going to think about this painting or look at this painting. And then there becomes more optionality to go into a positive experience instead of immediately going into a negative experience. Does that make sense?
So I'll give you an example of just a conversation recently I was having with my wife that this reminds me of, is that we both used to work for this tech company. And to me, like professionally, it was one of the better times of my life. But the final year that I was there had like its rough patches. Several years of great, 1 year of poor. And if you would have asked me any time in the first, 3 years after departing, I would have only had negative things to say. Bad associations, bad stories, bad people, all that kind of stuff. And I was talking to my wife about this, and she had made a derogatory term about the company. And I had said, you know, you work there, you made a bunch of money, your best friends in the world were people that you met there. And she had said, maybe it wasn't all that bad. That sounds like similar to what you're talking about.
Totally. And the other thing I wanted to mention about it is people with trauma, and I'm going to include people with TMS in this because I'm pretty sure that everyone I've ever worked with TMS has trauma in some capacity. We get stuck in patterns of being in fight or flight or freeze. And so that's where we immediately go. If something happens, I'm either activated into fight or flight, which that's going to be what you're just talking about. Everything's bad, usually. And then we might just drop into freeze, where it's like, oh my God, my life sucks. I'm really depressed. I just want to hide out in my room. And with somatic experiencing, as we reprogram the nervous system, you're able to go through these normal fight or flight experiences and then come back to a neutral baseline instead of getting stuck there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. How, one thing I'm curious about, there's a close friend of mine, I adore her. She had an episode, God, this was probably in July, maybe June, could have even been May. She had fainted, like lost consciousness, hit her head, had a concussion, and it's been this cascade of a variety of different health issues ever since. And kind of doing the doctor-to-doctor thing. The very first doctor that she saw, as she started kind of having a lot of these health issues after the fact, had summed this up to it's stress-induced. The fact that you're continuing to have symptoms is a stress-related thing. And I think maybe she sort of ignored that or didn't really want to accept it. And then now had another appointment just a couple of days ago and was told again that this seems stress-related. It's almost like it's like a PTSD response to this event of hitting your head, having this concussion. And actually they had, as a prescription, told her to read The Body Keeps the Score. In a situation like that, if this was your client, my friend, who, depending on what you say, I may tell her, hey, go listen to this, because I don't think she listens to this. But what do you do with something like that? Where it's several months removed, you now have a couple of different doctors saying that this is stress-induced and that it is PTSD. How do you unwind that? Even if you've just only had a few months of doctors saying, you know, let's do this test and that test and everything keeps coming up negative. How can we apply what you're talking about and trained into a situation like that?
So what's also interesting about somatic experiencing is there are different protocols for what to do. So I was talking about a more long-term chronic stress-related reprogramming of the nervous system. With event-specific experiencing, what we do is we work through the traumatic event to release the trauma from that event so that the person's not carrying the trauma inside, because with an event like that, you have all this trapped energy that needs to be removed from the body. So that might be meaning to complete defensive responses, such as a fight response of like, I hit my head, I want to like punch, or I need to freeze and I need to move through the freeze. I might need to move for the flight. And so we go very slowly through the event and notice what needed to happen and let it complete. And then often what happens is the person's freed up from that experience because they no longer have the incomplete defensive responses in their body.
Interesting. So they're almost playing the scenario as if, please correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm interpreting this wrong, replaying the experience to where, hey, I, not necessarily maybe that I didn't fall and have this concussion, but that I was okay afterwards. Like the, that is what it is. Okay.
Yeah. So a lot of the time, what we have to do is have the person sit with the fact that they're okay first before we work through the event. It's like, I actually did survive, because the body doesn't necessarily know that. I actually wanted to share an example that's super interesting that I learned about in my last training, that most people don't know, that when, so I'm thinking about your friend as having a near-death experience almost. And so the body might experience something as near death, and that's inherently traumatic. So what I'm thinking about is anesthesia. The body experienced that as inherently traumatic because it feels like a near death experience. So surgery is traumatic in just that way. So what was really cool for me during my last training was it was a touch training. And so there's a somatic experiencing protocol where we use touch to heal certain trauma that you can't necessarily get to through just tracking the nervous system and reprogramming that way. So I've talked about this on previous podcasts, that I had pelvic surgery when I was sort of at the start of all my new understanding of TMS, before that, I should say. And so my teacher did a demonstration on me of releasing trauma from the joints. And so we were talking about my pelvic surgery, and he went through and somehow released all the trauma I had from that surgery. And what happened was I was taking these really deep breaths and basically almost experiencing dying, but not in a scary way. And then I stood up afterwards and I said, wow, I don't need to be special anymore. And I feel like a normal person. And then for the first time in my life, I felt my legs.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So I didn't know that I had that.
What, and maybe the brain's just too complex to answer this question, but what is it about, you know, two people can have the exact same surgery. Like I had a shoulder surgery in 2016. I didn't have, you know, I anesthesia, what, like you talk about anesthesia, that was a wild experience for me because they had me walk into the operating room. They had me lay myself. It wasn't how I imagined, like, cause in the TV shows and the movies, I feel like they're wheeling you in and then you just have your surgery and then you pop out. Whereas I walked into the hall or whatever it was. And then they had me lay down on the table. They said, okay, count backwards from 100. And I got to like 99.5 and then I was out. And then I woke up in recovery, and I didn't have, you know, there wasn't anything residual in terms of the experience, but I have friends who have had shoulder surgeries, same thing. They have a completely different experience and it is a traumatic experience for them. What's the difference between the two people in that regard? Like what, and again, if the brain's too complex to necessarily answer that question, giving your best guess would be helpful.
My best guess is that trauma is completely subjective, actually. So for one person, they might experience something as traumatic because it's too much, it's overwhelming to their nervous system to the point that they can't be there. For another person, it might be like they're not overwhelmed by it. So in this case, it sounds to me like it wasn't too much for your system. But for friends, it might have been too much for them. And it's because we all have different capacities in our nervous system. We all have different programming. And it's like, oh, okay, that's me versus that's them. Like, for example, I have a an exaggerated startle response. So when I hear, I don't know, I don't have a good example at this moment. I guess my boyfriend burst into a really long, loud song the other night, and I just immediately went into fight or flight, and I couldn't calm myself down.
What was, was it the TikTok song about corn?
Yeah, it was a TikTok song. So he's actually the one who showed me that video, by the way. So yeah, he just suddenly burst into this loud song, and I was like, I felt blown out. And he asked me, like, do I need to announce to you before I sing? And I was like, no, you don't need to announce to me before you sing, but that loud of a sound that suddenly triggers me into fight or flight, whereas someone else might be not triggered by that at all. But yeah, for me, that's like a whoa. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Well, and that's interesting. I also think, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm thinking about this incorrectly, but could it have anything to do with, because you had said, you know, some, it is like trauma is incredibly subjective. It almost seems like it also just has to do in general with like, what's your individual tolerance, or how far into constant or chronic fight or flight are you? Because if you're somebody that is kind of amped up all the time, it seems like smaller events or smaller instances could have a greater impact on you than somebody that maybe is not that wound up. Does that make sense?
You're totally right. So what we're talking about is window of tolerance.
Okay.
So when we're working with healing the nervous system, we're working in increasing window of tolerance, so that here's your capacity when you start out might be really small, like you're saying, like a little tiny thing might make someone immediately go into fight or flight, and then they can't get out of it. Whereas someone else with a larger window of tolerance, which means that they can be with more stuff, like it doesn't bother them as much, they might be a little triggered, and then they can go back into their baseline. It was super interesting. During my training, my teacher was talking about how they did this study with monks and regular people. And the monks got actually more triggered by certain things than regular people, but they could move faster back to their baseline. So I think that's really cool too, because that's talking about resiliency. So the other part of this is, oh, I might get triggered by something someone else doesn't get triggered by, but I can come back faster. Does that make sense?
It's not really all that different from athletic training, because there's a big marker in, particularly in endurance training, and even short burst training, where you're trying to get to a max heart rate. Say you're sprinting, or you're doing a really intense CrossFit workout, and your heart rate hits 175. People that are typically in the better condition, just physical condition, it's kind of like almost like a race to who can get back to 100 or lower faster. And it sounds like that.
Yeah, exactly. Which is really cool, because I want to reiterate that all of this can be changed. So what you're saying is, like, basically comparing it to that, it's like, oh, window of tolerance is an endurance thing, where it's like, okay, I just keep building this muscle. Like, okay, I can be with more with this. I can be more with that. So the other thing I'm thinking about is, in somatic experiencing, we start with being able to tolerate little amounts of stress. Like, one of my practitioners said to me recently, Julie, why don't you notice something that's a little annoying? like a two. Because so I was at LAX recently, and I was in this lounge, and there were people everywhere, and they were sitting everywhere. And one thing that really annoys me about being in LA is that people are always talking about the industry and influencers, and going back to TikTok. So I'm sitting there waiting for my boyfriend, and these two people are like, you know, you need to do this to get more influencers, and you need to go to your target audience, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh my God, this is so annoying. And I had to say to myself, this is just a little annoying, Julie.
Yeah.
Not, you know, you can sit with this really stupid, or your subjective experience of this being a really stupid conversation, and not be like getting like, oh my God, they need to shut up. I can't. So it's this really cool thing of being like, oh, let's have this level of discernment instead of this extremely traumatic response. Like sometimes I give the example of being in line at the grocery store. Like some people get so angry if they have to wait. And it's this sort of training with yourself of being like, is it really that important? Right?
I observe this all the time. Like when I'm out like walking the dog and I just see people's responses to, you know, sometimes like a light goes green and somebody doesn't go right away and the second person in line freaks out, or even just the like people honking horns at other people driving. It's something I've never done because I've always just kind of been like, that's just, you're adding like a minute and a half onto your day, maybe at most. Whereas other people will lay on that horn or press that horn, and our experiences are completely different. And it sounds like that's what you're talking about, is just overall an interpretation of it.
Right. And the interpretation of it is a bodily response. So this is something I think about a lot too, and why I've changed my practice so much, is that your interpretation is actually coming from your nervous system and brain, not from like a, like, oh, I can talk myself out of this. So whether you're in fight or flight or freeze, or what we're going to refer to as like a ventral vagal state, which is rest and digest, or being able to be connected to other people, that's going to dictate your response to something. Does that make sense?
It does. It sounds like I interviewed a, gosh, I wish I could remember the episode name. I interviewed a psychotherapist out of Canada a few months ago. And like a phrase that he used in that I found myself using a lot in the subsequent days and weeks after that was lowering the stakes, really, on mm-hmm. all situations. That how helpful that can be, because everybody, or a lot of people, tend to think that, you know, every situation is like a life or death, when really very few are that, you know, have that much of a risk involved. So his whole thing was lowering the stakes.
I say that to every single one of my clients.
Yeah.
I'll say the stakes seem really high in this situation. In reality, are they actually that high?
Yeah.
And pretty much the answer is always like, no. But your brain is interpreting it as life or death.
Yep. Well, I'm curious that, The LAX example that you gave, you said that was after going through the training to do that,
or something? Yeah.
Okay. So how long did the whole training last? How long did you go through and do the training?
3 years.
Okay. So maybe it's tough to put yourself in 4 years ago, Julie Markowitz, but if you did, and you did that exact same exercise and you're at the airport and you're listening to these conversations, you had said recently it was a 2 out of 10, 4 years ago, what would that number have been?
12 out of 10.
I kind of thought that's what you were going to say. Well, I expect you to say like 8 or 9 out of 10, but beyond the maximum level. Okay, that's good to know.
So it's super interesting. It's been an amazing experience for me to really focus on retraining my own nervous system. And it's going back to that idea of being in my bedroom. And I'm talking back to beginning of pandemic type of experience. So I was alone in California after I moved here, and then the pandemic hit, and I started to notice when I did this training how basically everything in my environment felt dangerous to me.
Yeah.
And this is after a ton of psychotherapy, but all psychodynamic work, not any nervous system work, except I did a bit of touch work for a few months. So I started to be like, oh my God, literally everything is a trigger for me and everything feels traumatic. And it's so amazing for me to be able to go out into the world now and experience basically very little as traumatic.
What I wrote down as you were, I forgot exactly what you were talking about, why I wrote this phrase down a second ago, but ways where people can apply what you're talking about, like, into their daily life. Like, there's an element of, like, one thing I think about, for instance, is this is a weird example. The new Apple Watch came out today, and the new, as we're recording this, and the new Fitbit Sense comes out in a week and a half. And I've been looking at these two devices because I'm thinking about which one would I like to get as my next wearable. And both of them have this really high, what's the word I'm looking for? Emphasis around stress and winding down. Like, that's a lot of the verbiage that they're using in their product marketing for these products. So how could some, because it seems like what you're describing would be incredibly valuable for somebody if they could do this even little by slowly, little things that they could do every day or every couple of days to almost sort of like wind down, turn down the volume and lower the stakes a little bit just in their everyday life. I mean, what are some examples of just, you know, common person, maybe they have some aches and pains, sure, but they're not kind of going into the very thick of it. Like, you know, you were talking about the pelvic surgery. I know we've talked about a variety of issues over the last 3 or 4 years. So somebody that's not like in the thick of it in this really painful period of time, but like, you know, the common person, what can they do to sort of apply this to their regular life? What are some recommendations you could make?
So Eddie, before I answer that question, I just want to connect with you over this. When we talked about how you always like to have the best electronics.
Yeah.
So I recently decided I needed a new car, a 2023 car. I needed the newest MacBook Pro and I needed a new iPhone. All at the same time.
I was about to say, if you're going to do that, you've got to do those in alternate years. I guess that means on the refresh year, you do get a whole bunch of new stuff. So there's that side too.
Well, this year has been really awesome for me. I got my full psychotherapy license and I got somatic experiencing and I've just been going through a lot of positive changes. Healthier. So, but back to your question, one of the main exercises that we start with in somatic experiencing is looking around in your environment and noticing whether it's dangerous or not, and trying to find something neutral or positive. And for a lot of people who have serious trauma, that's going to be really rough. So it's continuing this practice of, is a tiger really coming to eat me right now?
Yeah.
No? Okay. So here we can lower the stakes in this experience because there is nothing actually dangerous. Our bodies, our brains might be interpreting it as danger, but it is not actually dangerous. And so it's that repetition of like, okay, this isn't dangerous. Can I notice how in my experience I could take in that it's not dangerous? And that's sort of what's lowering the stakes. Does that make sense?
It does. And it could be, like you had mentioned earlier, it could be something as innocent, essentially, as a painting in your bedroom. But could it also be, I mean, I hate to use examples like this, but there's, you know, Twitter's a really miserable place a lot of times. But there could be a story of anything. Here's a good example. Not too far from here, there's been this string, and I'm in the it's called the Neighbors app, but it's like everybody's Ring cameras. And there's been this string of people that kind of leave their garage door open during the day. They don't, you know, they're inside working or whatever. Don't really think much of it. Somebody comes in, steals their bicycle, steals something, you know. So like, I remember as a kid, if I would have something stolen, that was like capital T trauma to me, big T trauma to me as a little kid, like getting stuff stolen. So how would somebody work with something like this where there really is, you know, it's not a painting in the bedroom. And again, it's all subjective, but something serious or something that really terrible happened to somebody in a particular place. How do they go back to that place and revisit it?
It takes a level of capacity in your nervous system to be able to sit with that, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the times what I have to do with people before we can go there is do a lot of work on the positive. So in somatic experiencing, we call that the counter vortex, and the trauma is the trauma vortex. So it's working on the counter vortex of, okay, what do we like? Okay, I like trees. Okay, I like animals. How does that work inside? And then having enough of that built in to be able to be with the negative experience so it doesn't feel capital T traumatic to you anymore. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. It just sounds even more stake lowering, basically. It's kind of what that sounds like to me.
You know, I just thought of a story that I think I told on your podcast, and I'd like to tell it again in a different way, where it's, I learned in somatic experiencing how it could have been different. So I think I told this story about when I was going through the whole process of trying to figure out why I was having pelvic pain. And I went to a neurologist, and she said, I think you should see a psychiatrist. And at the time, I interpret that as, you're crazy.
Yeah.
And as I was going through the training, I talked about this event again, and this shift happened inside of me where I was like, wait a minute, she wasn't being nasty. It would make sense for her to refer me out to a psychiatrist because there was nothing actually wrong with me neurologically.
Yeah.
So this wasn't traumatic.
Yeah. And interpret it. Do you remember how you would have told that story prior to any of this training? Like what?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd say, you know, and then I went to this neurologist and she said, you know, you need to see a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And so she was telling me that I was crazy.
Yeah. It reminds me of one thing. My wife is so good at this. My daughter, my oldest daughter, started third grade last week, and the teacher sent home this letter where he had said, basically, you know, like we want to get to know the students and kind of what makes them tick and all this kind of stuff. My wife had wrote out that, you know, our daughter is very enthusiastic about reading. She's very enthusiastic about art and math and music and PE and all this stuff. The thing that she tends to struggle with is around how she sees people treating her. And so every situation, every argument, every incident with a friend on the playground or anything like that is the absolute worst thing ever. You know what I mean? So everything is either, like, it's either 100 or it's 0. There is no in the middle. And so a lot of what we're working on with her is really just interpretation, sort of reframing of these, you know, these playground incidents, which is really sort of what they are. And I know, like, kids can be shitty sometimes, and that's just the way that it is. But it sounds pretty similar to the difference in the way that you would have explained those stories 3 or 4 years apart.
And I have so much empathy for your daughter, because that basically explains my entire life until recently.
I should never call you.
Everything that happened to me was the most terrible thing in the world.
Yeah. I mean, she was telling me a couple of days ago. So school has only been in now. Today is day, let's see here, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Today's day 8 of school. So on day 6 of school, she came home and had told me, well, okay, let's back up. Day 1 of school, she had said that Carol's her best friend and Charlotte was being really, really mean to her. Okay, so then we fast forward to 2 days ago. So it had been 1 week of school. And now Charlotte is her best friend and Carol's being really mean to her. And she's never going to be friends with. And, you know, she said the same phrase about different people, but then they sort of reconciled over the course of a week. And so stuff like that is really, you know, it's challenging. I don't know. It's a very much a balancing act, because in one, and maybe you could weigh in on this, on sort of what you've learned over the last few years, but in one sense, with a daughter, yes, but with a friend or with a family member or whatever, you want to honor the, you know, the shitty experience that they're having, but then also be able to sort of aid and assist them in lowering the stakes. How does one go about doing that? And it can just be a friend too.
So something that's really interesting that I've also changed in my practice is I work with parts. I do parts work. And so it's, I think of all of us having this system of children inside of us and thinking about what is this child part of me need. So I'm thinking about your daughter And how old is she?
She's 8.
Okay, she's 8. So first of all, eight-year-old girls are very dramatic, right? So yeah. There's some of this that's developmentally appropriate. But I think it all starts with validating, you know, wow, that was really mean. I totally get why you'd feel that way. And then it's this, when we're talking about this sort of nervous system stuff, it's helping her calm down. So being like holding her, helping her notice what's happening in her nervous system too. And I actually had a client once that told me about this book called Hey Warrior, which teaches children about how stress in their body works and like about the amygdala and all this stuff and how to work with calming yourself down. So it's like, oh, this might feel like the worst thing in the world right now, but let me notice actually how to calm myself down, whether that's I need a hug, whether that's I need to go away for a little while, like, I don't know, like do a little physical work with her or something like that. And so really to notice after she does something to calm her nervous system, does this event feel the same as it felt then? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It does. Hey, Warrior, I'm putting that on my list because the concept that you're talking about does sound, I mean, it sounds like trauma or TMS work or somatic work for kids, like in a way, like it just sounds like a good understanding of that. Because it is difficult to explain to somebody that young reinterpretation or reframing when they're that age.
Yeah, and I think the reframing comes from noticing an experience from a different nervous system state, which I think kids are smarter than we give them credit for. So it's like, after I give you a hug, does this feel different to you?
Yeah.
Even teaching kids meditation can be really helpful. Like observing this from a different perspective. If I sit with it for a minute, does it feel the same to me as it felt when I was in this other state? But teaching them coping skills as well, like giving themselves a hug, tapping themselves, looking around, did something really, really bad happen to me? And I think I love the idea of teaching kids about this whole idea of nervous system, because I think we should all know about that. And just using more simplistic terms to teach them, because I think there's actually a lot of resources out there about it.
It's just not, I do feel like it's tough for me to try and recall everything I would have learned in kindergarten, first, second, or third grade. But there's a lot of things that Zoe will come home and tell me that they learned about that I wouldn't have even, I feel like I would have remembered it as a little kid when they talk about some of the social, emotional work, and like there is meditation. Meditation isn't the right word. It's very close to it. Elements that are taught, at least in our district now. And so I know that it's in kind of the collective conscious of education, at least in our area, over the last few years, that I don't think existed 25 years ago, or I guess now longer than that, 28 years ago. So I think it is something that is, I think it is a little bit of a shift in education, at least here it is.
I think there is a movement towards it, but it's still not good enough.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that most kids are taught in school to name their emotions or how to calm themselves down. Everything's very centered around this didactic, you need to take in this information about math or science, and not how do we socially interact with our peers.
Yeah.
And how do we regulate ourselves? Because I think if kids can learn to regulate themselves, then they would really bring that into adulthood and feel better and not have to do all the work when we're when you're our age.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Totally. Yeah. My wife doesn't give herself nearly enough credit, but a lot of the things you're saying are things that she talks about with our kids. And just, you know, being able to be adaptable and just understand that you're going to work with, meaning interact with, but you're going to work with a lot of different people that have a lot of different viewpoints that see the world in a different way, and being able to adapt yourself in order to exist in the world. He said it in the All the Rage movie that Michael Galinsky did about Sarno's life. But this rapper / poet Prince A had said that I spent so much time in my life trying to change everything around me and instead change myself in order to deal with the world. And it sounds like that's part of what you're talking about too. Something that children could really learn is that to be able to just cope better and build more resilience over time.
Yep. Children, adults, all of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's super important, and there's just not enough focus on it. I have a teacher that said just living in the world is traumatic. So it's like we all have to learn to slow down, notice, live in this world. And, you know, I to bring in politics a little bit, the day the Roe v. Wade thing happened, I felt like I couldn't get out of bed and I was crying. And I asked one of my therapists how I was supposed to go on. And she just said, we have to live in this world and you have to go on with your life no matter what the outside circumstances are. And I've had to carry that with me since it all happened and all of the other stuff that's going on in the world. And it's hard, but as you're saying, we have to adapt and we have to realize what's in our control and what's not in our control. And I think that's one of the best things we can all do is be like, is this actually in my control? And if it's not, that actually could be freeing in a way.
I had an awakening of an experience early this year with exactly what you're talking about, where I'd had it's like the end of February or very early part of March, this really like horrific relapse of pain, some really intense lower back spasms that were awful and they wouldn't go away and it kept holding on. So this was the end of February and I got all the way to mid to late April and I was at a baseball game and was sitting in the crowd and, you know, I keep shifting side to side as you kind of do like when your body just hurts. And almost like I was sitting down on the 100 level, but I was almost looking at myself as I was perched on like a ledge on the 2 or the 300 level and looking down at myself and just saying like, dude, you don't have any control really, you know, you don't have really much control over anything. And just that, like that realization, I felt instant relief. And it's been tremendous. It's been long lasting. And I keep getting brought back to, I used to have we may have talked about this before, but I used to have this really intense fear of flying that was for a long time from the time that I was the first time that I flew, which was probably 1995, all the way until 2010. And like, it was really bad where I would get really, really sweaty and my heart would start racing. And I'd grip onto my wife's like thigh for dear life as the plane is taking off and landing. But I was in this really intense, turbulence on this flight to Dallas in 2010 and just started imagining the plane crashing. We're in the air, it falls. And I just said to myself, like with almost like with open arms, like if a plane's going down, I can't do anything about it. And I'm okay with it. And it's just whatever happens, happens. And my fear of flying disintegrated in that day, like that quick. It was amazing. And I joke with people that I've had that exact same attitude in the last year, with COVID. My whole family got it. And I have had this attitude of like, you know what? Like it's going to happen eventually. That's just the way that the wind blows, and whatever happens happens. And there's not a lot I can do about nature. So, there's really no reason for me to sit here and, you know, be afraid of something like that happening. And I've taken care of COVID patients, and I've, you know, done all the things that I would have otherwise done. And I've one of the very rare, according to NPR, I'm one of the under 10% of the people worldwide that has not had an infection. And you know, part of me sums that up to, you know, just kind of being okay with that. I forgot what made me blast off into the airplane story, but whatever you said made me think about it.
I think we were talking about control.
Yeah, control. Exactly.
Yeah. So this happens to everyone all the time. We forget that the only thing we can, well, first of all, I want to say major snaps to you, because that's exactly what you all have to do, what you've done with yourself. It's like the only thing that we can control is our own behavior.
Yeah.
That's literally it. So if we could all just go back to, wait, the only thing I control is my own behavior, then we feel so much freer to be like, oh, I can't control this. I can't do anything here. Huh, that's interesting. I can't control people's reactions. I can't control whether, you know, someone does this to me, or, you know, sometimes we get outraged when someone does something to us, and it's like, well, I can't do anything about it. So, okay, let's move on. Yeah. Right. How important is this?
Yep. Yeah. You know, you've said the sentence a couple of times through this podcast that it's something that you've changed in the way that you practice. And we've gone a few minutes over from what I told you that we would. Do you have just a few more minutes? I want to elaborate on that a little bit if you've got some time.
Yes, I do.
Okay. So, talk about how your practice has evolved from when we would have maybe most recently had an interview where it was just you, which would have been probably mid-2020 or so. What's different about the way that you work with clients now, and sort of who is kind of your typical like prototype client, where like you see that profile and you say like, this is the person that I can really help?
Early childhood trauma, parents who were misattuned and had trauma themselves, usually have chronic pain, chronic illness, that type of person, usually have dissociative symptoms as well. So my practice has changed in that I really track someone's nervous system, which means I'm constantly noticing what's happening. So someone might be talking about something traumatic really fast, and I'll say, hey, can I pause you right now to check in? And I won't let them keep talking until they take a deeper breath. And it's not that they intentionally take a deeper breath. It's that based on that pause, inherently the nervous system goes, oh, okay, I'm actually safe right now. And then that's the whole nervous system reprogramming. It's like slowing down. In the past, I might have just let someone keep talking. And what I've learned is that there's a limitation to talk therapy, because if you just keep talking about your trauma, then you're re-traumatizing yourself.
Yep.
What heals a traumatic story is being able to really sit with a bunch of different stuff and being able to experience it from the bottom up in your whole experience, what actually happened. And that whole idea, what you said, it's like, I survived, is a super important element. And we often stop at a different point, and I'll say, you know, that's really important. Why don't we just sit with that for a minute? That you said no to this person, or you did something different this time. Why don't we notice how that feels inside, instead of just being like, okay, good job, you did that. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. It almost sounds to me, when I hear you talk about that almost like, and not to say that any session with you prior, meaning as a client, would have been fast or sped through or anything like that. I'm not saying that. But the way that you're explaining it, it almost sounds like maybe in your approach has slowed down. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And a lot of what I notice in myself is that I'm slowing myself down too, because I'm focusing on co-regulation, which means that my regulated nervous system helps my clients regulate too, instead of just feeling like I'm holding space. Does that make sense too?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that I've started being mentored by Janina Fisher. Do you know who she is?
I don't.
So she combines sensory motor therapy with IFS. And so her model is seeing parts as defensive responses. So we might have a fight part, a flight part, a freeze part, and bringing our prefrontal cortex online, which is our adult self, and learning to take care of those parts. So a lot of times what I'll say to a client, in addition to this whole slowing down, is like, you know, let's notice that that's a part of you and that's not all of you.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, oh, okay. So I'll constantly be naming, yeah, that's a part of you. That's not all of you. So that's another thing that I've done differently.
Yeah. There's certain examples that I think about, like personality traits, that remind me of what you just said. And maybe to put a bow on this, and just a comment maybe, from you, is that a lot of what, you know, you're, I think even the name, I don't have it on Google anymore. When I was typing up and looking for the different episodes that we had done together. Oh, okay. Taking Back Your Power. That was what we titled episode 105, which was January 8th, 2020. That a lot of your mantra and everything you spoke about was taking back your power. And even though your approach sounds like maybe it's changed as a, would I say clinician, as a therapist, I still get underscores of that as an element of what it is that you do. So maybe to close up, like, is there a way that you can take the concept of taking back your power and apply that to some of the changes that you've made in your practice?
Taking back your power is realizing that you have the capacity to heal in a different way and realize what's in your control, what's not in your control, and coming out of the sense of helplessness and realizing that helplessness is just a part of you.
And I also, something that came to mind when you were talking about the painting at the very beginning of this is that someone looks at a painting and they start getting flooded with these bad memories and instances and responses and reactions and all that. But the way that you would teach it now, to somebody that's dealing with the painting example, is that they are reframing or retelling, maybe is more important, reinterpreting, retelling the story that surrounds the painting. And to me, there's no bigger example of taking back power than actually retelling a story. That's what came to mind for me.
And Eddie, it brought up something for me as well. And taking back your power is the traumatic part of that might come into your mind. And then you take back your power by saying, you know, we don't need that anymore. Let's focus on what's really cool about this painting.
Yep. Julie, you're a gift. Every hour with you goes by faster than the last one. So thank you for coming back. I'm sure we'll do this again. But thanks so much for coming back and sharing some of this stuff with us.
Thanks, Eddie. I really appreciate the opportunity. Yeah.
Thanks, Julie. Take care.
Okay, bye.